Faithful Radio is pleased to present Church of the Masses with award-winning Catholic columnist, screenwriter, and media consultant, Barbara Nicolosi.
Hello, welcome to Church of the Masses, the show on the Virgin Most Powerful Radio Network that deals with the intersection of faith and culture. My name is Barbara Nicolosi, and I am a screenwriter, producer, educator, and maker of culture and commentator on all things culture. I'm famous for hating Christian movies and because I don't like bad things done in the name of God. So welcome to the show. This is, we talk about anything that's of interest to people of faith that's out there in the culture. And so got a few things to talk about this week, some the huge fixations in the national imagination, which have to do with the impeachment of Donald Trump and the death of Kobe Bryant. And we'll talk about some other things too. The Oscars are still generating buzz, and Sundance is going on. So there's a little buzz coming out of Sundance, too. And then I have a great guest again. We have invited Karen Hall back. She is my colleague at Regent University. She teaches writing for film. And we're going to talk about the problems of training people to be great writers and storytellers today, the challenges of it, and how we go about it. Basically, Karen and I have been collaborating in this realm for about 20 years now. So we kind of have a lot of experience, and so we want to share that. And then in the last segment, I'm going to review this movie, Parasite, which is all the rage, nominated for Best Picture and Best Foreign Film, among other things. And so I finally dragged myself out to see it. It's a movie from South Korea. And so I have some reporting to do on what I'm calling the most overrated film of 2019. So you get a sense there of what I'm going to say. But let's jump in here with some news of interest to you. And, you know, I think the Kobe Bryant's death has just kind of gotten the attention of most normal people. You know, the people on the extremes, 10% right, 10% on the left, are completely obsessed with the impeachment. But I think most Americans have turned it off. And yet the death of Kobe Bryant has become a huge occasion to talk about a couple of important things. And one of them is his faith. So his pastor came out with a speech, a talk today that said that Kobe had been at the 7 a.m. Mass with his daughter. And then someone else chimed in a couple days ago with the truth about Kobe getting his act together when he had that very public, accusation of sexual misconduct. And then he turned to his Catholic faith as a way of getting himself together. And I didn't know that about him. I didn't even know he was Catholic. And so, sure enough, apparently it was a big thing for him. And that he had been that morning at 7 a.m. with his daughter, Gianna. Both of them died in the crash along with seven other people. And I'm glad to see that finally the other seven people are getting some mention now in the media 4 days later. It seems like everybody's just talking about Kobe. But, you know, seven other people died. There's several families. One family lost three members. Another lost two. So terrible tragedy there. But this is life. You know, Jesus was asked by the apostles, whose fault was it that tower fell on those Galileans? And he said it was nobody's fault. These things happen, right? So anyway, I think that, we need to pray for all of them, everyone who dies suddenly. And especially this week, we're praying for Kobe Bryant and thanking God for the great talent he had and that he used it to inspire so many people. The other news is the impeachment thing. And I am a policy political animal, so I've been tuned into that quite a bit. And I had to say, I finally have started just turning it off. It's the same thing over and over and over. And part of that is, it seems to me, the paucity of the case that the House managers introduced. There's just not that many charges. There's two articles and the same thing over and over, and they keep spinning it in more vitriolic language, you know, calling him a cheat and a, you know, and just every kind of bad name they can. And then the House, the president's lawyers are responding. They've done some beautiful constitutional studies for us all. So it's been a national civics lesson for anybody who is up to paying attention. But even then, you know, there's just not that much depth in the arguments because the charges are so shallow. So I think this, I'm not sure what this is proving. I don't know culturally. It seems that most people have turned it off. And if I, who love all things politics, have turned it off, how much more have the average person? And in fact, last night, 100,000 people turned out to see Donald Trump at a speech in New Jersey, of all places. So it kind of would indicate that the impeachment spectacle hasn't exactly won people over, if they're doing that. But anyway, other news is that we had the March for Life this week, and it got the most coverage it's ever gotten in my lifetime, and that is because Donald Trump attended. And I have to say, you know, I've been going to the March for Life since I was a child, really, I had. And when I moved to California, I couldn't go anymore, but I've always been very tuned in. And, you know, I remember when we had pro-life presidents like Reagan and Bush, and they told us, George W. Bush, they told us they were pro-life, and yet they never came to the March for Life. Why was that? But Donald Trump was there. Last year he had Pence go, and I thought that was incredible that the vice president came. And this year, Donald Trump came, and so the media had to cover it. I mean, they just had to, and they hated it, every minute of it. But it got a huge, huge response from the pro-life people of encouragement. So God bless him. God bless him for doing that. I guess he fears he has nothing to lose, but makes you wonder why other pro-life politicians, so-called, never did it. They just weren't as brave as he was, or they weren't as gutsy, or I don't know what, you know, too much prognostication. I want to warn everybody about a project out there that's called Troop Zero. And this is a movie about Girl Scouts going to the moon. It's on Amazon. It's an original Amazon movie. You know, it's for kids, and it looks like, oh, wow, this will be fun. It's a, you know, comedy drama. And, you know, what it's about is, you know, yeah, little girl wanting to be an astronaut, whatever. But there's a whole transgender subplot in it, which is so annoying that that they snuck that in there. So I'm warning you, don't let your kids watch a Troop Zero. And it's got an all-star cast, you know, huge names, Allison Janney and Viola Davis. And yet it really is just a piece of propaganda to promote transgenderism among little kids. And especially young women have been shown to be incredibly vulnerable in this area, right? They, for some reason, young girls between 10 and 13, 10 and 15, I guess, are the most likely to embrace this notion of changing their gender. And many of them, they just need a little suggestion. I think probably it's a rejection of the over-sexualized post-sexual revolution culture that they've grown up in. They don't want to be a porn star. And they're angry at men for you know, making that seem like that's their only option. And so I think that that's why they're hating their own femininity and they're rejecting it. But whatever, this is completely irresponsible, and it's worse than irresponsible. It's downright lousy to do this. And the movie only gets a PG rating from the MPAA. So be warned, Troop Zero is to be avoided by your kids. There is, we're at the year anniversary. I was high on this film last year. It was a documentary that came out, and they're promoting it again as Valentine's Day comes up. And this is the Dating Project movie that was done by Paul's Productions and Family Theater, produced by my friend Megan Harrington, a former Act One alumni, or she is an Act One alumni. And so they're recommending that groups of young people, especially those who don't have someone to go out with on Valentine's Day, get together in groups and screen The Dating Project. And you can find it on the DVD or Amazon Prime. It's on YouTube. And go and so if you haven't seen The Dating Project, it's a lovely, lovely thing, no matter whether you're in the dating thing or not, or you just like people who are, or you're just interested in where we are as a culture. It's a beautiful thing. It'll make you laugh and cry. But it really does give you a sense of where young people are today and how confused they are. And just really beautifully done. So The Dating Project is out there, and they're trying to have a movement for people on Valentine's Day who don't have someone to go out with, or if they do, to still get together in a group and watch The Dating Project. I wanted to also point out an article that was in the Federalist. I guess it was last year, but it was getting some more play. Recently, people were sending it around, and it was about the Notre Dame fire. Remember now, just recently it's come out that they're wondering if they can even fix Notre Dame. Just a few weeks ago, that came out, that the structure, the superstructure, has been so harmed that first they just thought they were going to have to put a new roof on. But now they know, oh no, it's going to be much worse than that to repair. And this article by Maureen Malarkey, which people have been sending around, is asking the question of whether the French people want to restore Notre Dame out of just an aesthetic sense or some kind of cultural sense, or out of piety. And she's bemoaning it a little that it isn't out of piety. I say, who cares? Let them restore it no matter what, and then we can clear up our motives afterwards. That's my philosophy about a lot of things. All right, my name is Barbara Nicolosi. This is Church of the Masses. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is Terry Barber with the Terry and Jesse Show. I'm here with Gil Olivetti. He is the president of the Catholic Men's Fellowship of California. Gil, we got a men's conference coming up.
I appreciate you having me on, Terry, to share about our Rise Up, O Men of God, The Church for You Does Wait Super Saturday Conference, and it's Saturday, March 28th in Covina at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, 344 West Workman Street in Covina, California.
Who are the speakers?
We have some great speakers lined up. We have Steve Ruta, former captain of the LA Fire Department. He's dynamic. Mm-hmm. He's energetic. He will really keep the conference moving. We have Monsignor Tim Nichols, the pastor from St. John Vianney's.
Oh, yeah,
he's dynamic. Mark McElrath, Father Darren Merlino, a trained exorcist. Charlie Eshelman, a past Navy SEAL. We have Deacon Omar Uriati, who is from our parish, St. Louis de Marillac, and Father Joseph Shea.
And I'll be there myself, giving a little plug for Virgin Most Powerful.
You can reach us at catholicmen.org. Tickets are on sale there. Just follow the link. Tickets are on sale at eventbrite.com. Just be sure to get your tickets now till the 31st for $35, and $45 after that till the day of the conference.
Sign up for this men's conference. Call Gil at 626-841-9090.
I'll be sure to answer your call and give you all the information you need for the Rise Up, O Men of God, For You, The Church Does Wait conference. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate your help.
God bless you.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
Hello again. Welcome back to Church of the Masses. My name is Barbara Nicolosi. Thanks for tuning in. And please do tell your friends about the show. We need more people to download it. I'm seriously considering kind of stepping away because not enough people while listening, and it's an awful lot of work to do this every week, especially for my producer Hannah. So if you can spread the word and, you know, get more people to start listening, I think there's no other show quite like this out there. I think it would be a shame if it went away. But anyway, there it is. So what we do here is we talk about the intersection of faith and culture. And I also always try to highlight people who are making stuff. People who are engaged in producing culture. And my next guest is somebody who's been doing that since looking like probably back to the late 70s, mid 70s. She started in television on the show MASH. She was on Eight Is Enough and Hill Street Blues. She was on the whole run of Moonlighting. Then she did a short, I guess a miniseries with Oprah Winfrey called The Women of Brewster Place, and then Northern Exposure, Judging Amy, The Brotherhood, The Good Wife, truly an extensive career. And now she is a judge for the prestigious Peabody Award, and she's one of my colleagues teaching film writing at Regent University. So welcome again, Karen Hall.
Thank you.
Thanks for showing up, and you know, we had such a good time the last time that my producer said, you need to get Karen on again, you guys have good chemistry. I was like, really? You know, it's like only 22 years working on that chemistry, right? But I think we had it at day one. You know, Father Kaiser told me you'll like Karen Hall, and it's funny, you know, he was always right about other people, but he could never really see himself that well. But he told me that. He told me to invite you to be a guest for – I was running Open Call, if you remember, at that time for him when I was working at Paulist. And he said, you'll like Karen Hall. You should get her in as a guest. I was like, okay, you know, and sure enough, I like Karen Hall. But anyway, Karen and I have been friends since about 1997, I think. Yeah. So, because I was in Hollywood in 1996. So, anyway, so I was mentioning to my audience here that we've been doing this thing of instructing young people in how to become great writers, or better writers, screenwriters, since 1999 with Act One, and then now we both do it on a level of higher ed in graduate program. And so, yeah, why don't we just kind of throw it out here? We were sharing this week, Karen and I, because our students did our famous credo exercise, which we basically Karen ripped off from her former professor from William and Mary. And then I ripped it off from Karen. And now it's a constituent element. I don't ever teach screenwriting without making them do a credo. Karen, why don't you explain to the audience what the credo is and why it matters to someone who thinks they might want to be a writer, any kind of writer?
Well, it started with me walking into my mentor's office, having just signed up for his class and we'd never met. And I said, I'm Karen Hall and I want to be a writer. And I expected him to fall on the floor and exclaim how lucky he was to be able to teach me. But instead, he just looked at me and said, well, do you want to write? I thought, that's a stupid question. So I found out many years later it wasn't a stupid question. But after that, the first thing he asked me is, how do you know what you want to write if you don't know what you believe? And so he always said his students start with a credo, which is, I believe, in Latin. And I just made my students do this. And what he had us do was take 10 topics that we knew that we had strong feelings about, and then just write a stream of conscious paragraph about each one or a page about each one. And we kept it in a notebook so we could go back and revise it, because he was right in thinking that what was our credo then would not always be our credo. Mm-hmm. But it does a couple of things. One is it just helps you think of yourself as, he used to call it self as source. To me, it grounds you so that you're not writing, you know, the studios are buying zombies this week. And instead, you're writing something that's really from your heart and you're passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when I went to Northwestern, my professor, Del Chapman, had an exercise which is very closely related, and I use that one too, called the Look Within. And basically, she had 10 questions that she would ask us and then make us just write. And then, you know, everybody would write for like 5 to 10 minutes. And she's like, okay, now we'll go to the next one. And again, it was similar. It was things like what is it that makes you fall in love with someone? How do you know if, or describe the scene around the dinner table when you were growing up, how did you feel, things like that. And, but it was the idea of getting you to kind of look at yourself and your story as the source for what you're going to write. And I had one of my students this week say to me, that look within exercise and the credo has changed the whole way I'm thinking of the way I was in high school. And I can't believe it. So I was marveling how, transformative it is. And you said that one of your students said a similar thing.
Yeah. A student wrote to me this week and said that I can't say it as eloquently as he did, but it basically said it made him a better person and a better husband or something.
I think that, when I started this program, I met with David McFadden, who you will recall, we were on the board of Act One together. And he was the creator of a show called Home Improvement, which will be familiar to the audience, and among other things. And I said to David, what am I trying to do here with these writers, these young people? And he said, you're trying to get them to love writing. He said, that's what we have to do. You have to help them love it, because otherwise they won't stay at it. But I do think the credo and the look within is the beginning of loving writing, because I think it gives you something that you can be passionate about, that you really come to say, wow, if I don't say this, no one will. And so therefore, yeah, I'm not going to see writing just as a job. I'm going to see it as a mission or a vocation.
Right. And I also think that, if you sit down to write something, but I have another exercise I make them do where they write down their five of their favorite movies, and then they write what themes those movies have, mm-hmm. and circle the common ones, and that gives them an idea of what themes they resonate mm-hmm. for them. And so if I were to sit down and write something before, I always loved redemption stories. So I think, okay, how do you write a redemption story? Well, you need someone who has to be redeemed from something. And the odd thing about that in terms of your credo changing is when I took that exercise, I'd say 10 years ago, then my recurring theme was redemption. And I did it recently, and my recurring theme is identity. And it made complete sense to me, because I'm kind of grappling with, I've never been a woman this age, and what does that mean? And I had all the young, exciting years planned out, but now what? So I've always kept a credo. It's always really interesting to look at how it changes and how your priorities change.
Yeah. So I think that's the first thing we're going to recommend. As if you're out there listening and you say, yeah, maybe I should try my hand at writing, go and Google the writer's credo. There's all kinds of YouTubes on it. There's articles, or get Lewis Catron's book, The Elements of Playwriting, I believe. And he'll have that in the beginning, the credo exercise. But that's where we think you should start. Before you get, start buying software and, buying books on 3-act structure or whatever, the first thing you have to do is find your voice. You have to find your mission and what you have to say. What are your themes? And then you quickly have to move into the professional thing, right? So we are not people who think that, that there isn't a science to writing, that writing is an art and a science.
No, I did credo for a week, but I did the same thing that Dr. Catron did, which is, I'm telling you this for use from now on as a writer. So, I'm telling you how to do it. But
yeah. So that's the second part then of working with beginning writers, is that there's stuff you have to learn. And it's, I said this week to, I'm making a case at Regent that we have to have tougher admission standards for the graduate programs in the MFA and the MA. And in fact, there aren't any right now. They took them away a few years ago. which to me is a moral problem, because there are people who are getting in the program, you know, who don't have any native chops. And we wouldn't do it in a music program, would you?
Please put me on that committee.
Okay.
It's amazing to me to have, you know, graduate students in screenwriting who've never even thought about the fact that a screenplay is written. And, you know, I don't want to be teaching people at a graduate level when they're in graduate school.
And so that problem of everybody thinking, you know, we live in such a democratized society, everybody, you know, you can do whatever you want, whatever you say. No, in some things you have to have talent, and you can't do whatever you want. And talent tends to show up early. So you probably were really good at it when you were a kid, and then the world, whatever, or whoever around you or whatever may have distracted you off of it. But the idea of, you know, finding again what you're good at, you know, discovering where your talents lie, you have to have turn of phrase to be a writer. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then you're probably not a writer. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that is just desperately unfair, isn't it? You know, my sister's an opera singer.
Yes.
You know, she has a 14 note range. I have a 5-note range. There it is. You know, so screenwriting is similar.
No matter how much I willed it. no, it's true. And I'm hoping that Regent will, you know, that we'll build a good enough program that it'll be well known and we will be able to choose from, you know, many, many applicants.
Well, that's the idea. But I think that if you want the best writers to come, you know, and our pitch is going to be, we're going to be the best place for believers, for Christians to go and learn how to be great visual storytellers.
Right, right.
So if that's going to be the pitch, then you have to make sure that, you know, like you can't put in your writing, you know, ask the students to be in a writing group with someone who's semi-literate, you know, and expect the talented kids to do there. So that's the next thing. I think that the problem of convincing writers and it's, you know, that there's stuff to learn here, you know, that is it's such a challenge, particularly with this generation. And so we can pick it up after there. My break's coming up. So stay tuned. This is Barbara Nicolosi. I'm talking to screenwriter Karen Hall, and this is Church of the Masses.
This is Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio. This March, VMPR, in association with the Catholic Resource Center, will be hosting a special conference for the Adoremus Society. Adoremus at the Triduum, a conference on the spirituality of the Triduum liturgies, featuring speakers Father Joseph Fessio, Dr. Anthony Lillis, and Christopher Carstens, addressing such topics as developing a liturgical spirituality, the spirituality of Holy Thursday, the spirituality of Good Friday, and the spirituality of the Paschal Vigil and Easter season. It all takes place March 14th, 2020, at the historic Sacred Heart Chapel at 381 West Center Street, Covina, California, 91723. You can register online at vmpr.org or call now at 877-526-2151 to reserve your seat today for Adoremus at the Triduum.
This is Terry Barber. I want to thank you for supporting Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And here's an easy way to support us by going to smile.amazon.com and type in Catholic Resource Center or Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And when you log in your Amazon account and you purchase products, a portion of it will go right back in supporting Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And it doesn't cost you a dime. I want to thank you ahead of time because that supports us year-round. May God bless you and your family.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
And hello again. Welcome back to Church of the Masses. I'm Barbara Nicolosi. This is the only show in Christian radio that talks about the intersection of faith and culture. So please tell your friends and tune in. If I don't start getting more people listening, then I'm going to conclude that this is not meant to be. I'm that egotistical. So anyway, we're here talking about how to help people who want to become writers, how to train writers. But specifically, I'm thinking people out there in the audience who think they might want to give their hand or try their hand at storytelling, either novel writing or short stories or web series or whatever. You know, come and apply to the MFA, MA program at Regent if you want to become a screenwriter. So we're talking about the challenges of that. And so, Karen, just going to throw it at you. What do you think is the toughest part of working with young writers today?
The problem I'm having that is the most frustrating to me mm-hmm. is that they won't accept a person who has done this for, in my case, mm-hmm. 40 years as an authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, because I was going to say the problem with graduate students is they come in at all levels. But I know how to blast you through that, you know, brand mm-hmm. new screaming amateur writing phase, mm-hmm. you know, into mm-hmm. somebody who looks like they know what they're doing. But I cannot get people to listen to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mm-hmm. had a student who has moved on to be someone else's student, but they would, like, every single note I gave her, I'd get an individual email about that note telling me why I was wrong.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, you're so busy being defensive that you can't even hear what I'm saying. And B, it's not wrong. If I tell you it's not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a similar experience last semester. I had a freshman student who, the students had made little short films for me in groups of four. And I was asking them first to critique their own film, and then I asked the students to give notes on it, and then I gave some feedback. And so when I said to her, so what do you think you could have done better in your film? And she said, nothing. It's absolutely perfect. It's exactly what I want it to be. And it was not good. Let me just say that, you know, the groups of, there were like five groups, and hers probably came in fourth in terms of the quality of the project. And so I said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, Mel Gibson asked me to give him notes on The Passion of the Christ. You know, I said, you know, come on, you can't be better than Mel Gibson, you know, here. And she just looked at me and she said, you know, well, you're, and so then I started to give her notes. And she goes, well, that's your opinion. And it's like, yeah, it's an informed opinion. So it's not equal to yours. And I find myself, I had to even say that.
Actually, it's not, you know, frequently it's not an opinion. It's an objective fact.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So that's something endemic in the society today that, you know, when I was learning to be a screenwriter, if my professor gave me notes, some, you know, sometimes they hurt my feelings or whatever. But I internalized that she knew what she was talking about because she had experience and, you know, training, and she was teaching at Northwestern in the graduate school. But my students, very often, if I give them a note, they accept it too often as a violation of their First Amendment freedoms, you know, like, you know, how dare you tell me I can't do something the way I want to do it. And so I think that's one thing that if somebody out there is listening, you got to find mentors here and then you got to listen to them. You know, you got to listen to them and you have to trust. You cannot learn without trust. And so the problem is, I think a lot of our Christian kids that we're encountering, you know, I'd say at Regent, but we found this at Act One too, is they're so ready for the world to come down on them, you know, especially as Christians, that they just don't trust, you know. And I'm like, I am a Christian, I'm on your side, but they, you know, they can't hear me. So what would you say then? Okay, so if you had to say, here's the essential book to read to get started as a writer, what would you say?
You know, the book that I would hand somebody doesn't exist yet, because I've tried to find it. And I actually started writing a book so that I could get it published and have something to use in my class. Because, you know, I think the way that I teach is the way it should be taught, and I can't find a book that does it that way.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's why I wrote Notes to Screenwriters, right, which I'm showing to the camera right now, you know, because I couldn't find a book that did what I needed in a book, you know. And so, yeah, so that was the incentive there. So, yeah, I was going to say, besides my own book. Yeah.
Oh, yes, Barbara's book, definitely. That would be the book. But, you know, but your book is kind of the same. What my problem with books is they have wonderful information as kind of an overview. And I want to teach in crayon, because I really think that in order to, you know, structure is hard, and I think you need it in your head all the time in crayon. But there, you know, different books have different things going for them. And when I was starting, it was a long time ago, there were much, much fewer books. But I just thought, I'll read everything, and then whatever I agree with will stay with me and be worthwhile, and whatever doesn't work for me, then, you know, didn't hurt to run it through my brain.
Yeah. I love aspects of the novel by E.M. Forster. It's an old one. You know, he wrote Howard's End and Room with a View, among other things. And but he wrote a wonderful book about narrative storytelling, you know, narrative, and called Aspects of the Novel.
I have a book that I love that's old too, and it's called The Art of Dramatic Writing.
By Agri? Yeah. No, that's a great one.
And Jose Agri.
Yeah, I had one of the professors say to me recently, what book do you think, you know, that we would, you know, the students should read? And I said, well, you know, I'd love to see them start out with Screenplay by Sid Field. And he's like, but it's so old, you know, and it's like, who cares? You know, it's not that old, you know. And it's a great kind of beginning text, you know. And so,
because first of all, I'm trying to convince them that what they need to write first is a basic, normally structured three-act screenplay. Because you can't write Memento the first time out. And so Sid Field is a great book for that. Like the book that I like, the Lejos Agri, is mostly about character motivation in a really in-depth way. And it's fascinating to read. So I don't see anything wrong with recommending old books. And I've seen a lot of other people recently recommending both of those books.
Yeah. No, they're great. And there's a reason they've lasted, you know, whereas I think something like Save the Cat hopefully will die any minute. I hate that book because
please,
the students.
Please let it die.
Yeah. The Save the Cat tells the students, you know, the formula for the, you know, the studio blockbuster, which has succeeded in making every screenplay read like every other one. So, yeah. So now we have the other problem. Sorry.
Save the Cat makes my head explode.
Yeah, me too.
Like,
No. No. So the next problem we have is that we have students who are people of faith, and they want to do something good, not just good in that it works as entertainment, but they want to leave the audience better off after than they were before. And, you know, that's a beautiful pastoral mandate that we have as Christians, right? You know, and so, but the problem I find is that, you know, as Flannery O'Connor said, way too many Christians are trying to save the world when they should be trying to save their work, you know, first.
Yeah. I have so many thoughts on this that, you know, I have way more thoughts than you have time, but it's something that I'm spending a lot of time with my students on this semester. And the first is to try to broaden their concept of what a Christian movie is. there's a movie that you and I both like called The Way, Way Back that I'm making them watch, and their discussion topic is going to be to discuss it as a Christian movie. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing in it that says Christian. But if you look at it from the point of view of the protagonist, you know, one of the characters who pulls the coming-of-age protagonist into where he needs to be, you can look at him as a messianic figure and see him pulling the kid out of the sin that's surrounding him.
Yes.
But I need them to understand that, you know, every movie does not have to be an altar call.
No.
I really think that we move in Christian life in increments more than we do. I saw a movie that changed my life.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that we're dealing with a lot of evangelicals, and they want that altar call. On the Catholic side, what I find is every movie has to be a saint's life, you know, and I'm just like, for heaven's sakes, you know, can't you tell a story of just a regular person who's struggling with the darkness? Why does it have to be Saint so-and-so, you know? And yet the Catholics can be just way too stuck on that, you know, and it's getting in the way.
Yes. We just watched On the Waterfront, which is a wonderful example of a Christian movie.
Exactly. This is somebody who doesn't want to be a bum, right? He wants to be a good, noble person, and he's stuck.
Exactly. No, and also, look what they get away with the preacher is saying in his sermon.
Yeah, Karl Malden's speech is, it's amazing. Amazing, So, all right, well, I think then the last thing I want to say is I don't think you can be a writer in isolation. And so I've been pushing with all of my students have to be in some kind of a writer's group, because my experience is that writers who are in some kind of accountability or feedback thing, at least at the beginning, you know, I think when you get to your level, you probably don't need it so much. But in the beginning, they write more, they write faster, they write better, and they get over their kind of, you know, that they're in their own echo chamber and they need their work to be put on the table and have people react to it. And then they go, oh, wow, I didn't realize that you all thought that was going to be funny, or that that wasn't funny, or something like that. I mean, how do you feel about the writer and writer's groups? Oh, no. Say yes or no.
Maybe.
All right. You know, we'll have to have Karen back another time. We're gonna talk about the movie Parasite next. Stay tuned. This is Barbara Nicolosi. Karen, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Brothers and sisters in Christ, this is Jesse Romero. Join me on a pilgrimage of faith and discovery to Poland for the 100th anniversary of the birth of St. John Paul II in May of 2020. Together, we'll experience the faith, beauty, and culture of Poland and become imbibed with the spirit of St. John Paul II. We'll visit the town of Wadosi, where John Paul was born, and the city of Krakow, where he was ordained and later became bishop. We'll also travel to Jasna Góra and visit Our Lady of Częstochowa, and we'll have a chance to venerate the original image of the Merciful Jesus at St. Faustina's Convent and the city that St. Maximilian Kolbe built for the Immaculata. Finally, we'll pay a visit to Auschwitz, where St. Max Kolbe was martyred. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to worship and discover your own faith at places where St. John Paul II grew in his own love for our Lord. For more information on how to join this pilgrimage, visit my website, jesseromero.com. Brothers and sisters in Christ, this is Jesse Romero.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Church of the Masses with Barbara Nicolosi.
And hello again. Welcome back to the last segment of Church of the Masses. I'm Barbara Nicolosi, and I'm here to talk about the movie that all the rage. I mean, if you every year there's usually one film that is like the art house favorite, you know, the darling of the entertainment industry crowd. And, you know, it's the must-see if you're in the business. And this year's film is called Parasite. That is that. Now, this film has come out of South Korea, and its name is Gi Sang-chung. Gi Sang-chung in Korean. And this movie has the critics' score on Rotten Tomatoes, right? Rotten Tomatoes is the aggregate site of movie reviews. The critics' aggregate score is 99% on this movie out of a possible 100. Nobody gets that, right? And even the audience score is at 93%. I am calling this movie the most overrated film of 2019. And I'm trying to figure out why everyone is raving about it. I can't quite figure it out because it doesn't have the political stuff going on, you know, that you would say, okay, that's they're all behind it because it's feminist or because it's about, you know, transgender people or oh, it's an attack on Christianity. This movie doesn't have that really. I mean, it's about the rich and the poor, but it's not what's fueling it. So I think that what's fueling this is that the idea of Parasite is about a group of people, a family, that literally leeches onto a rich family. They're poor, and they start to play them, and they figure out what the rich people want, this rich family, and then they start pretending to be able to give it to them, and they're just very shrewd, and they start just sucking the resources out of this family and getting rid of all of the people who are in their way. And then the movie goes a little further, and you find out that there's a couple of people who are living in the, or a guy who's living in the basement, you know, in a tunnel underneath the rich person's house, unbeknownst to them. He's literally a human parasite, kind of just sucking stuff from the rich people. And he doesn't ever want to get out of the tunnel. He doesn't want to come up. And so I think that maybe one of the reasons people are loving this film is that idea of there's just so many parasites in our world today, people who are parasites, right? In reading Entertainment Weekly's review by Leah Greenblatt says about Parasite, the movie is a Rorschach of who you identify as parasite and host. It's a test, it's a test that, you know, many people are going to be likely to fail, right? So this idea of, wow, we are a society of people who are pretending to be something they're not, just to get stuff, you know, to get money and to get a proximity to fame or, you know, whatever, that maybe that's why everyone is just raving about this movie. I can't really come up with why, because it is a mess as a narrative. Now, this is interesting. I'm reading another review. This is from the Arizona Republic. Bill Goody-Kuntz says that Parasite is a nearly perfect film. I mean, au contraire. I thought the premise was interesting and was engaging, and it was funny in the first act. But But then the second act, the whole thing unravels, and then it just goes on and on and on. It's 132 minutes long, 2 hours or more. And that's so long for a movie nowadays. You know, movies used to be 120 minutes, that would be 2 hours. Now they're between 90 minutes and 110, and most of the time closer to 90 now. So to go to a 132-minute movie is huge. The other thing about the film was that the tone changed so radically that I thought it was a complete loss of creative control. The movie, when it opens, is, as I say, it's a funny little dark comedy, slightly dark, but not terribly dark, quirky and clever. And then into the second act, about the midpoint, it becomes brutally violent. I mean, we're talking people's heads smashing into stone walls and blood, you know, their skulls being cracked open and people being stabbed to death. It just really gets gruesome. So to me, it didn't match. But what I like about Parasite, some things that are people responding to. I think the production design is the palette of the film, the cinematography, it's very kind of lovingly done and controlled. There are some beautiful frames here. I think number two, the acting. So these are all South Korean actors, and they do a really good job. There's some, the two female leads, the one who plays the daughter of the family that's the poor family, and then the wealthy mother, they're beautiful, and they really do a great job. But after you take out acting and then the look of the film, from a story standpoint, I just thought it was a mess. And I actually found it quite disturbing because I wasn't sure at the end what it was trying to say about, was it good that there are these people that are living as parasites, or is it bad? You know, there's also a kind of weird, the poor people in the movie are smarter than the rich people. The rich people are so caught up in being, stylish that they don't realize they're being taken by these poor people who have kind of studied what they want and how they're going to deliver it. So in that sense, that's kind of interesting. It does make you, look at that problem of rich people becoming all caught up in style. I remember I went to Korea once years ago for an animation event, and I was shown around by a Korean animator woman, and she was lovely. And I was so impressed with how Seoul was such a modern city and everything. And I said to her, wow, you guys have better stuff than we do here, in terms of cars and machinery and computers and everything. She goes, yes, we don't need anything from you, but we want your soul. And what she meant by that was Americans had a kind of cool way of not worrying about things and cool, kind of being above it, just kind of interested in life without being full of fears. And that in Asia, that's tremendously attractive. It's my theory of why so many Asians that come to this country vote Democrat, because the Democrats seem to them to be cooler. But anyway, so that's the subplot in Parasite. The language is pretty bad. There's no real sexuality. Well, actually, there is. There's one pretty graphic sexual scene in the movie. So there's that. I guess what I want to say is this movie is very odd. It's not like anything you've ever seen. And again, maybe that's why people are raving about it. But somebody needs to have the courage to say the Emperor's clothes here are a little bit threadbare, and I'm going to be the one to say that. This movie, Parasite, the Korean film that's nominated for both the Academy Award and for Best Picture, and it's nominated for Best Foreign Film. Probably will take foreign film. I can't imagine it not, with all the raving that's been going on. But it won at Cannes. It won the Palme d'Or from Cannes. You have to say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? I just have to say, Parasite is an interesting idea that unravels. So in the end, the storytelling is a fail here. So there you go. I'm not sure what else to say about it, but it's an R for violence. It's an R for some sexuality, and it's an R for language, which is interesting because it's in Korean, but you got the subtitles there that are, you know, cursing. So I think if you're not a film person, if you're not a film buff, then I would pass on Parasite. It's just it's not going to be the kind of thing people are watching in a few years. It's not going to be a classic. It's weird and confusing and not in a good way. So that's what I think about Parasite. So the other thing I want to give you just mention is that, and I'm going to review this next time, that The Crown is back in season three of The Crown. So if you haven't been watching The Crown, you should. It's for grown-ups. There's a couple of, you know, there's only like two or three problematic scenes in three seasons, but still, you know, there you want to be, you know, you want to, older teens will be fine, but I think that there's a little bit of nudity in, I think, season two. Other than that, it's a beautiful, beautiful character study of the Queen of England and Elizabeth, the longest reigning monarch, and her just awful luck in family. You know, that this wonderful person, the thing of the crown is that you have this wonderful person, and she just has terrible, terrible luck in the people around her and her family. They're all one worse than the others. And that's her mother and her husband and her kids and her sister and her uncle or whatever. You know, everybody is a mess except for Elizabeth. And so there's a line in The Crown that says that the crown has a way of finding the head that it should be on. And that clearly is the story there. But I'm going to review that in more depth next week. But do watch The Crown. It's on Netflix, and I have issues with Netflix and, you know, signed off of it for a while, but I had to get back on to watch The Crown because it really is worth it. So, so that's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Please go to our Facebook page, Church of the Masses. If you want me to review something particular, feel free to send a donation to Virgin Most Powerful Radio and say you listen to Church of the Masses and you'd love to keep us going. So please do. We got to pay Hannah, my producer, something. So please feel free to make a donation. Thanks so much for tuning in. And let's hear from you. And please do continue to support Virgin Most Powerful Radio. They're trying to do something very neat here, a good, authentic Catholic commentary on a whole broad range of topics, theology, the Bible study, etc. So thanks very much for tuning in. And my name is Barbara Nicolosi. This is Church of the Masses.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.